a spirited game of Pong.
There we go. Oh, trick shot. You're done. You're done.
You may recognize the sound of this ancient video game. You may also recognize the sound of two old codgers, me and author Walter Isaacson, strolling down memory lanes to compete in Pong before a live and very entertained audience. I was winning, but I let him tie me. We also remembered our very first computers.
My first computer was an Osborne, you know, the one that you got to hold up that Adam Osborne made, and then a K-Pro, and then finally a Compaq, and Ben Rosen, who lives right down the street here, was then chairman of Compaq, and he was a friend of my father's. He grew up in New Orleans, and I remember calling him once saying, I can't get it to, you know, you had to do this floppy disk, and he came over and actually put in one of the first hard drives with a screwdriver.
Oh, nice.
And those were the days, which we don't have anymore, when you could actually open up your computer. You could jack in. You could put things in the circuit the way Wozniak wanted. Nowadays, everything's so sealed that you're a little bit intimidated.
I used to be able to do that with Chevys as well. But
we are right.
Yeah, exactly.
Walter Isaacson is CEO of the Aspen Institute and author of the new book, The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. Last week at the World Science Festival, Walter talked about how his own discoveries of what computers could do in every facet of his job as a writer and as the brains behind Time, Inc. for years led him to explore the lives of the people who made the original digital revolution come to be. In our conversation, Walter insisted that the notion of the solitary genius is just a folktale. The digital revolution of our time is a collision between the techie brilliance of some scientists and coders and the spirit of the counterculture renegades who had no use for rule books and instructions, but loved the Grateful Dead, the Allman Brothers, and the idea of tools.
There's two places you could say the computer was invented in the United States. We biographers know that we distort history a little bit. We give a little too much credit to the lone inventor who in the basement or the garage comes up with a light bulb moment and innovation occurs. And if you're a romantic historian or if you're Jane Smiley, the novelist, or somebody like that, you pick out John Vincent Atanasoff, who at Iowa State University makes a circuit, a electronic logical circuit, and is able to invent the first electronic circuit board. Now, he's a loner, and so it's kind of romantic. He has one graduate student, but no team around him. So he can't really get it working. He can't get the punch card burner to work. And when he goes into the Navy, they don't even know what this contraption is he's been building, and they dismantle it and throw it away. You have another team that's just the opposite, led by John Mauchly. He was part of that British-American cadre of people who love sharing science. So he goes all over the place because he wants to build a computer. And he's like a bumblebee. He picks up pollen in places and cross-pollinates things. So he picks up all these things. And he finally hears this guy in Iowa State. He actually runs into him in Philadelphia. And for 4 days, he drives to Iowa State with his kid just so he can see the computer. So then he comes back to Penn, and unlike Atanasoff, he builds a team. He gets Presper Eckert, who is a great engineer. He gets, you know, mechanics, people with grease under their fingernails, and he gets about 70 women PhDs in math who are doing the calculations. He picks six of them to secretly get training at Aberdeen Proving Ground to reprogram the computer. They understand the innards of the computer. When John von Neumann comes from Los Alamos and needs to have the machine not do ballistic missile trajectories, but to do a test of a hydrogen-type bomb, it's the women who reprogram. And that's when you really get a real computer.
Let's launch ahead to really when the convergence becomes complete, because suddenly, with solid-state electronics and the ability to kind of home engineer enough computer capability to begin to program on your own, suddenly we're in the realm of Gates and Jobs and the Apple gang.
What happens at around in the early 1970s is the hobbyist comes first. Ed Roberts creates the Altair, which does almost absolutely nothing. It just has a few lights that blinks and a few switches and you can do it. But since it all comes back to good product launches, he gets himself on the cover of Popular Electronics and sends the Altair on the road to the Homebrew Computer Club, which is where all these, you know, hackers and geeks and all coming together in the early 70s. Now, a couple things happened. This guy, Bill Gates, is a sophomore at Harvard, has convinced this friend of his, Paul Allen, to drop out of school and move to Boston for no apparent reason. And Paul Allen, in that out-of-town newsstand right in Harvard Square, sees it says the Altair, grabs a copy, pays 75 cents, and runs to Courier House where Bill Gates is living and plops it down and says, this is happening without us. And Gates just starts rocking, as he used to do, or still does probably, and says, oh, my God, and it's exam period. And he blows off all four of his exams, and they just sit there on a Defense Department paid-for computer at the Aiken Computer Lab, and they code BASIC. But also, at that meeting, I mean, this is, like, huge. It's a great movie scene, if anybody wants to make a movie of this book, because sitting there is Steve Wozniak, who thinks personal computers are stupid. He's building terminals that connect the mainframes. But then he looks at this, and he looks at the specs for the Intel 8088, which is what allowed this to happen. He says, I can make something better. I can make it that connects to a monitor. So he does. And he brings it to the next meeting of the Homebrew Club with a TV that's carried by his friend from down the street, Steve Jobs. And Woz hands out for free the Apple, the design. It's not named yet. And finally, Steve Jobs, after the second or third meeting, says, wait a minute, we can go to my parents' garage and make these things, and we can sell them and make money. And that's how Apple is born.
Let's shift to the Internet. Part of the innovation of the Internet itself comes from figuring out how to take data and transmit it. Packet transmission is the key insight to transmitting data, because the sort of initial notion would be the mail, where you take the message, you put it into a box, and then you send the box. And of course, messages are going to be different sizes, and all the boxes will be different sizes, and there's all sorts of complexity associated with that. Just work at UPS, and you understand the problems there. But packet delivery was really something amazing and had a difficult sell in the beginning.
Absolutely. And packet switching breaks it into just a small little things, puts a very small finite block, puts a header on it, breaks up the entire message as if you took a whole long letter and put it into 50 postcards and let them each follow a different route. This has two functions. One is that Paul Barron, who is one of the founders of packet switching out at RAND Corporation, he's doing it to help survive a nuclear attack. If the Russians hit our communication system, he wants America to be able to retaliate. But the really cool thing is the people who did end up building it, the ARPANET, this is, because it starts off as a Defense Department project, are the research centers that the Defense Department is funding. And being research centers, they delegate it to their graduate students to figure out how to do the protocols. The graduate students are all graduate students indefinitely because they're avoiding the Vietnam War, and so they're staying in graduate school as long as they can. They aren't trying to help the Pentagon survive a nuclear attack. They want to build a system that can't be censored, can't be controlled, can't have a top-down authority. So they create this decentralized or distributed system of the Internet. That DNA, that the fingerprint, the sort of into the genetic code is inbred the notion of we route around authority.
Walter Isaacson is the CEO of the Aspen Institute and author of the new book, The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.